Welcome to Horticulture Hangover on News Radio KLBJ. You're in the right place to get answers to all of your questions about your lawn, garden, trees, and more. Now, here's your host, Colleen Dieter.
Good morning, everyone. Hi. Okay, so hope all you outdoorsy folks are ready for Monday for the eclipse. Everyone's talking about it. Once in a lifetime event happening where you can see a total solar eclipse from the comfort of your own home here in Central Texas. And I am so excited about it, I can barely stand it. I went to Portland, Oregon to visit my best friend who lives up there in 2017 when they had the eclipse, and it was spectacular. And Austin is even closer than Portland was to the totality. So I'm really excited to see it again, an even better view this time. So hope you all are ready with your glasses. I know Austin Public Library is giving out free glasses. So if you don't have any glasses to view the eclipse, you got to get them. You can use welding glass too if you're a welder. So I'm Colleen Dieter, and this is the Horticulture Hangover Show. I am a landscape consultant with ATXGardens.com, and I'm here to answer your gardening questions today. It's been an incredible spring for gardening. Couldn't be better. I noticed this week, I think I got a little cold damage on my tomato. I have one tomato plant. I've given up growing tomatoes, y'all. So I only have one. And I got it. The only reason I have it is because a friend gave it to me, because she grew them. And I don't know, or something's going on with it. It has the leaves are all distorted all of a sudden, and it was after we dipped down into the 40s week before last a little bit and got pretty cold. So I didn't realize how cold it was going to get that night, and now some of the leaves are kind of like curled and the stems are fat in a flat way, which also could be a virus or something like that. Could be a virus, but I'm not sure. I'm just kind of waiting to see what happens. It seems like it's getting worse, though. So I may end up pulling it out. But it's pretty cool. It's a dwarf type that I'm growing in a pot. So let's see. Somebody, some early bird who's with it, already texted me. I bet they had that loaded up on the phone last night, ready to hit send. It's too early. No, just kidding. Okay, let's see. It says, I love this question. The text message says, I have started planting bulbs every October. They have, however, not all come up. This year, I planted daffodils and tulips, and only one or two of them came up. What else can I do to ensure that I have a good crop of flowers in the spring? Okay, great question. This is something that I struggle with a lot myself, and a lot of my customers struggle with. So the thing is, with tulips especially, it does not get cold enough in Central Texas for tulips to grow here. The only tulips that will grow here are the species tulips, okay, which means they're not the great big ones that have been bred for centuries to be really showy big flowers. The species tulips are little itty bitty flowers. Like there's one called Clusiana that I'm quite fond of, and they're really short and very small flowers. And they will come up. If you plant them in the fall, they'll come up in the spring and they'll bloom. And then they usually die in the summer. And the bulbs disappear. They usually don't repeat. So they're really more like annuals here. Now, there's someone in my neighborhood who forces the tulips. So they get regular tulip bulbs, you know, that you would think of like Dutch tulips. And they put them in the fridge all winter and keep them in the crisper. Or if you have a beverage fridge, like so many good Texans do, keep it in the beverage fridge. Keep them in there all winter long and then plant them in the spring, like in mid-February, I guess, around Valentine's Day or even in January. I'm not exactly sure of the timing. And then they'll bloom because they've been exposed to consistent cold temperatures for a long period of time. That's called forcing. So I tried it once because of those neighbors inspired me. And their tulips are so beautiful. And, you know, y'all know I grew up in Ohio and we had incredible tulips every spring. And so I really love tulips a lot. They're one of my most favorite plants. And so I'm sad that we can't get them going here. So I tried forcing them a couple years ago. I planted them in a pot and it was just so-so. Wasn't worth the effort. I don't know how my neighbor's doing it around the corner. Folks around the corner have this incredible display every spring. It's really neat. So that's the thing with the tulips. And we've got a call coming in now. I'll talk about the daffodils in a minute. But we've got a call coming in now from Denise in Elgin, a regular. Good morning, Denise.
Good morning. Good morning. I appreciate your advice so much.
Denise. I appreciate your call.
Well, thank you. Things that I grow, and I try to stay native or well-adapted as much as possible, and they don't do well, so then I question, what am I doing wrong, or do I just not have the right conditions, or do the plants just really not grow that well here? Mm-hmm. One I've got now is Mexican honeysuckle.
Mm.
And my daughter has one in West Austin, Southwest Austin, and it is gorgeous in mostly shade. Just under some live oak trees, and I've got some under hackberries that get about 6 hours of light, sunlight in the morning, and then afternoon shade.
Okay.
Not doing anything.
How long have you had it?
It has been in the ground here 3 years.
Okay. And has the top frozen in the winter?
The top has frozen, yes.
Okay. So did it freeze every year? Has it frozen every year?
Yes.
Okay.
We've had a cold enough year every year to have it freeze here. We tend to stay a little bit colder than what Austin does.
Yeah, so it's been a tough time for them. That's one of my favorites, the Mexican honeysuckle. I love that plant. And I found, if it was planted in the past few years and the top keeps freezing, then they kind of struggle to come back. But make sure that you don't have any leaves or mulch touching the stems.
Okay.
Because what I've found is that the pill bugs seem to really like those plants in particular. And this year, because we've had some real regular rain, and it's a little bit wetter than normal this year, we're getting more pill bugs, which happens every now and then in the spring. And the pill bugs usually eat leaves and dead stuff, but sometimes when they get overpopulated and there's a whole bunch of them, they'll start to eat the leaves and stems of the new growth on the perennials emerging from the ground, especially when there's mulch and leaves like covering them.
Okay, and I did on all of my perennials. I did pile them up with leaves. I have a lot of fir oaks and red oaks, and I just pile the leaves over them and may not have pulled them back all the way.
Yeah, so pulling the leaves back is the thing that I found helps a lot. And there have been some plants this spring where I've noticed a lot of my customers are losing certain plants, and Mexican honeysuckle is one of them, from the leaves being like touching the stems and giving the roly-poly pill bugs a place to hide.
Okay, and this is growing in a bed with rock rose and the bicolored iris and the salvia greggii and so forth. So I thought it was the right amount of light, but I don't know if it's too much water, or like you said, because it didn't do well last summer either.
Yeah.
So even during the heat of the summer, it just didn't perform really well.
Okay. Yeah. I would give it another year, and see how it does. But, once they're established, they're really great. But it sounds like this one is maybe having a hard time establishing because of the weather.
Okay. So what kind of a supplement could I give it to kind of help it along besides liquid seaweed and compost?
Oh, that's what I would do, is the seaweed and the compost for sure.
Okay.
And it sounds like you have it in just the right spot. They can grow in shade or sun. And, you know, in mild winters, they're evergreen. So if we get a mild winter this year, it should have more of an opportunity to green up for a longer period of time. So, yeah, I really like them a lot.
So. All right. Well, I will make sure everything's pulled away from it, because when I think about my daughter's house and how well hers is done,
yeah,
it is in just like bare soil all around
it.
And it's like, how can this thing survive here?
I know. I know. It's so funny. Yeah, they have their individual needs.
I really appreciate your help, and I will give it a go still.
Okay, Denise, thanks for the call, and thanks for listening.
All right, thank you.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Yeah, this year I'm finding the Mexican honeysuckles are struggling to come back. Around town. I've seen this several times. Forsythia sage is another one. Seems like it's getting eaten by roly-polies, not growing back for some reason when they came back last year. What's the other one? Lamb's ears, too. Some of my customers have had lamb's ears getting eaten, and velvet leaf honeysuckle, too. And those are all plants with fuzzy leaves. And when they first start growing, the stems are fuzzy. And I wonder if there's something about the fuzziness that the roly-polies like. But we're at quarter after, so now we're going to go to a break. See y'all later.
This is Horticulture Hangover with Colleen Dieter. Call or text your lawn and garden questions to 512-836-0590.
Good morning, y'all. This is Colleen Dieter with ATXGardens.com. I'm a landscape consultant here to answer all your questions about plants and gardening and landscaping today. So I got another text message. It says, good morning. Is there a flowering Texas vine that can take full sun? We have an arbor to cover. Thank you, Tom. Hey, Tom, thanks for listening and writing in with that great question. Yes, there are plenty of nice vines to choose from that will grow in full sun, that are native to Texas. So definitely, if you have, depends how big your arbor is. Crossvine is my favorite. I'm always recommending crossvine. It blooms twice a year in spring and fall and has apricot colored blooms, and it is evergreen. You could also try Carolina jessamine, which is all the same characteristics as the crossvine, evergreen, and has yellow flowers. I love that one. Really great. It's supposedly poisonous. I don't know what that means. And then, like, I don't know if you eat one leaf if you're going to drop dead or if you are going to get a little bit queasy or what. But people always want me to say it's poisonous. And then I really like, there's one called coral vine, also known as queen's wreath, with hot pink flowers, and it dies to the ground in the winter and grows back at this time of year. It starts growing back and it blooms all summer long. That one's really nice. And I kind of like the vines that die, where the tops die in the winter, that are truly perennial and not evergreen. Because I feel like they're easier to maintain. When you have the evergreen vines, they start to grow all over themselves. And it's hard to know how and when to trim them. And it's nice to have the vine where the whole top just dies in the winter and you cut the whole thing down and force it to grow back. You can always do grapes too. I think grape arbors are wonderful. Of course, you have to be, you know, ready to harvest the fruit or accept some messiness if you get fruit. But you can't go wrong with grapes. Black Spanish is a really good one. So lots to choose from. Passion vine. Passion vines are great, especially the Incarnata native one. Passiflora Incarnata. They can get a little aggressive. I've seen them take over people's yards. But they get eaten by butterfly caterpillars. The Gulf fritillary caterpillars feed on them. And then they just disappear sometimes because caterpillars eat them and you have to replant. But they're really important source for butterflies. So you could do passion vine too. Really nice. So think about all that. Think about what you want. Oh, now we've got a caller. This is Ginger in North Central Austin.
Now we got.
Good morning, Ginger. How you doing?
Good. Hi, Chloe. Hang on just a second.
Sure.
Ready to go off.
Good morning,
Ginger.
How you doing?
There we go.
As far as the Carolina jasmine goes, many years ago, I had a neighbor across the street from me that had one, and one of their four-year-old granddaughters was sucking nectar off the blossoms.
Oh.
It is a respiratory failure kind of poisoning, and they had to do a tracheotomy to keep the child breathing.
Oh,
so
wow.
It is seriously poisoning.
Oh, good. Thank you for telling me that. I've always been wondering. So I really appreciate your call.
Yeah, it was a really scary incident.
Okay. And did she come out okay?
Yes, but
okay.
She'll always have that scar on her neck.
Oh, wow. Oh, my gosh, Ginger. Well, I so appreciate you calling to let me know.
Thank you for the program.
All right. Thanks for listening, Ginger. That's great information. Yeah, that is really good to know. And I was just having a conversation with someone about that this week, about the honeysuckle vines and how, yeah, kids will suck the nectar out of the flowers on honeysuckle vines. And then, yeah, and that you could get confused and try to suck nectar out of the Carolina jessamine flowers too. So if you have little kids, or I've heard dogs too, other animals and stuff like that, you may not want to use the Carolina jessamine. Because it sounds like it is really dangerous. So I so appreciate you letting me know, Ginger, because I had never heard how dangerous it was. So I'm glad to know. I want to go back to the bulb question that someone wrote in earlier and talk a little bit about daffodils And their smaller friends, the Narcissus paper whites. So daffodils are a little different. If you plant daffodils in the fall, there's certain types that will not grow here because it doesn't get cold enough here. But there are types that will grow here, especially paper whites and Narcissus, the little ones. Smaller flowers, they're still tall. The flower stems are tall, but the flowers themselves are small. So now I've had so many mixed results with those bulbs. Sometimes I plant them and I'll get lovely blooms, and then a couple years later, they won't bloom at all. This year, mine didn't bloom at all. I've seen some types that come up in old gardens with no care around town. In older houses, they just come up on their own. So it's all about trying to find the right varieties that will work here. And then as time goes by, you need to divide them to give them space so they'll continue blooming. If they get too crowded, they won't bloom. I have one customer who has like thousands and thousands and thousands of bulbs that he's planted over the years. And this year we got one paper white, and he was really excited and said, "Let's get more of those." And I said, "You've planted hundreds of them and we got one to bloom this year." And he was like, "Good point." So if you can get the right variety of the daffodil or Narcissus, then you'll be really happy. But it's hard to figure out which ones work. There's a good company called the Southern Bulb Company that carries those varieties you could try. But even with those, they're not very reliable, I found. So I'm going to recommend to you trying Dutch iris instead. My Dutch irises have brought me lots of joy. They were gorgeous this year. And really easy. I also have been growing tri-cornered leeks. Very nice. Very nice little white flowers. Leucojums are another nice one. They're not the same. It's not the same as tulips and daffodils. If you're from up north like I am, it's hard. I miss them for sure. But you know what else I'm growing are the amaryllis hippiastrums, and they are thrilling. So get some amaryllis instead and you'll feel better. Oh, man. I have one called Red Lion. Red Lion amaryllis. The botanical name is Hippiastrum. So gorgeous. And now it's 8:30. We're going to the news.
Welcome to Horticulture Hangover on News Radio KLBJ. You're in the right place to get answers to all of your questions about your lawn, garden, trees, and more. Now, here's your host, Colleen Dieter.
Good morning, y'all. You are in the right place. This is Colleen Dieter. I'm a landscape consultant at atxgardens.com. Check out my website. I'll be able to come to your yard and help you with your gardening questions. Or you can call me today at the station with your gardening questions, or text me, 512-836-0590. Okay, I got a great question here. Very timely topic. Someone sent me a beautiful picture of two branches on a peach tree just loaded with peaches. It's gorgeous. And it says, "Do I need to remove some peaches? It's loaded. It's a tropic beauty peach." I love it. Love it. Love it. Okay. Yes, you need to remove some. And I looked up my little article that I wrote. I did some research last year about thinning. So it's called thinning fruits, and it's the hardest job in the orchard. Okay, y'all, so get ready for this. Most palm and stone fruits, okay, palm fruits are apples, pears, and quince, all of those fruits that have a core. And stone fruits are peaches and plums and nectarines and apricots. Okay, they're the ones that have a pit. So palm fruits and stone fruits, the ones with cores and pits. Okay, they're related. They make more fruit than can be grown to a large size with good quality. All right, so if the tree has tons and tons of fruits on them, you've got to remove some of the tiny fruits from the branches by hand to control the number of fruit per tree, to increase fruit size and quality, and to ensure adequate leaf growth in the trees. Some trees, especially apples, need to be thinned, otherwise the tree will make very few or maybe no fruit next year. Thinning also takes weight off the branches, so it's less likely the branches will break under the weight of the fruit. So what you all have to remember is that these fruit trees are not natural. They are domestic fruit trees that have been bred to make tremendous amounts of fruit over 6,000 years, all right? And so they're kind of like pug dogs, you know. They can't survive on their own. They need us. They've been made by us, and they need humans. And so they produce so much fruit that they can collapse under the weight of the fruit, okay, and you get broken branches. And one of my plum trees already has broken branches from that wind last week and has little fruit on it, and I've already started thinning them. So what you need to do is peaches and apples need to be 6 to 8 inches apart from each other on the branches. Plums, about 4 inches apart. Pears, 4 to 5 inches apart. So you start at one end of the branch and you just move through and remove fruit. And I like to use clippers to do that. Because you can bend the branches trying to pull the fruits off. So you have to be careful when you do it. Okay, so it's peaches and apples 6 to 8 inches apart. All right. Plums, 4 inches apart. Pears, 4 or 5 inches apart. Okay. Now, it gets tricky because, you know, a lot of folks I know are probably saying, well, what about the squirrels? What about this? What about that? Birds are going to knock them off. The wind's going to knock them off. Yes. And some varieties naturally go through a process of dropping their fruit on their own. That's often called May drop or June drop because that's when it happens. But here in Texas, the drop might happen in other months. Sometimes wind, drought, animals will thin the fruit for you. But basically, by early May, so in a few weeks, you know, by early May, you need to make sure by then that the stone fruits and the palm fruits have enough space between them. Okay, so we're coming up on the deadline. So if the wind, squirrels, drought, natural May drop, June drop doesn't happen by May 1st, you've really got to thin them. And I'm already thinning mine. I really think around April 1st is the right time for thinning. The earlier the fruit is thinned on the tree, the bigger the remaining fruit will grow. All right, so keep that in mind, y'all. I've definitely seen tons of peach trees fall apart under the weight of the fruit. It's really common. So because of the shape of the tree and just how they are, they fall apart. So thinning is really important. And I've also had customers tell me they had apples that didn't taste good. You know, the tree produced a lot of nice apples, but they didn't taste good. It's usually because they didn't get thinned. And the plant can't make enough sugar to make all of those fruits taste good. It's just not possible. So the fruits don't have enough sugar content to make them yummy. So thinning is really important. How many fruits are you going to eat anyway? You know, I also started putting nylon socks over the fruit, which is hilarious, with twist ties to prevent them from getting infested with bugs, you know, worms, and to help prevent animals from eating them too. So you can get those little socks that they give you at the shoe store if you go to try on shoes and you're not wearing socks. Get those, double them up, put two on, and put them over the fruits that you want to keep. And then you really can, like, count the number of fruits that you're, you know, really planning on getting, and it'll make you feel better. And you can cover whole trees with, like, micro mesh, too, to help keep out animals and bugs after around this time, now that they're done blooming. Okay. So that's the story with thinning. It's really, really hard. I understand. I got another text message that is hilarious. It says, my polyethylene plants appear to be melting. What do you recommend? It's a little early in the season for plastic plants to be melting. Usually that I don't see that problem until August. So I'm really surprised, but it has been kind of hot recently. So I have a strong dislike of fake plants. And I've noticed an uptick in fake plants around town in the last few years. And it really bothers me. It's like nails on a chalkboard style dislike when I see them. Yeah, stay away from the plastic plants, everyone. It's no good, especially outdoors. Indoors is one thing. Okay. Yeah, sometimes it gets the job done. But outdoors, no thank you. All right. That's pretty funny. Thanks for your text. Let's see. I've got some more text messages here. Here's one that says, good morning. I have a large mulberry tree. Every year around this time, it takes on webworms. Yeah. How can I get rid and control them through the summer? Thanks. Right. Yeah. This is a really common problem with mulberries. They get webworms. So the moths come and lay their eggs on the trees, and then they hatch, and the worms, the little caterpillars come out, and they make a big nest of webbing around them. And basically, you need to try to pop open the webbing if you can. Like, use a pole saw or a rake or something to get up there and poke holes in the webbing, and so that wasps can get in. And the wasps will get in there and help control the population because they'll eat the caterpillars. So that's one way to do it. And also you can spray the tree with BT. I don't really bother spraying them unless it's on more than one third of the tree. If it's less than one third, then you don't really need to control it. The tree can handle getting eaten that much. Mulberry trees especially, they're so vigorous, they can handle getting eaten. So here we are at 8:45, y'all. So we're going to go to a break.
This is Horticulture Hangover with Colleen Dieter. Call or text your lawn and garden questions to 512-836-0590.
Good morning, y'all. Hey, look out for those plastic plants. They'll get you. Plastique. one of the listeners texted and said, used the term plastique. Yes, if you go to Target, you might want to buy some plastique plants. Watch out for those. Keep them indoors, y'all. Don't put them outside. Come on now. That's just plastique in the waterways waiting to happen. They're going to fall apart in the wind and the sun breaks them down. You're just going to put plastic. You're just putting plastic in the world. And I got another great text message here. Not about plastique plants. So funny. Okay, so someone sent a picture of a hydrangea. Love this. Okay, it says, "Hi, Colleen. I, too, am a landscaper and normally go native when possible. I have a client who is smitten with hydrangeas." Mm-hmm. "I do know they can survive anything." Well, okay, we'll get there. Okay, "but they are never my first thought. I found this one yesterday that sort of blew my preconceived bias as being old-fashioned or something. The color really popped. But how hard do you think it would be to keep it that color? Bright coral red. Thought I'd see if you knew if it's a new cultivar that may stay true to color despite pH. Is blue the default normally in alkaline soil or pink?" Yeah, okay, so that type of hydrangea it's category of hydrangeas called mop heads. So it's the kind that has a big ball of flowers. Okay, in an alkaline soil, which is what we have here in Central Texas for the most part, we have alkaline soil. There's some exceptions, Bastrop County, but otherwise it's alkaline around here pretty much. And you're going to be watering, if you use city water or well water, the water is also going to be alkaline. And pink is the default for alkaline soil. If you have acidic soil and acidic water, that same hydrangea will be blue. Okay. And where, again, I'm talking a lot about Cleveland today, where I grew up in Cleveland, people have these hydrangeas in the landscapes everywhere. And sometimes they are purple because the soil is close to neutral. So it's a little bit pink and a little bit blue. And some areas you see them, they're more blue, and other areas they're more pink. But here in Austin, if you have mop head hydrangeas, they're going to be pink. They're very unlikely to survive in the ground in the summer. It's too dang hot here for them, usually. Okay, they're just not very durable. I've never had them live very long here. I think of them as annuals. You know, it's like a plant that you'd get someone as a gift. Keep it in a pot, keep it out on the patio until it gets too hot and the heat will kill it. Okay, so it's not going to be a stalwart kind of landscape plant by any means. Eventually, the heat is going to destroy it. So number one mistake folks make with those is cutting them down in the winter. If you cut hydrangeas down in the winter, you're cutting off all the flowers. So don't cut them down. Now, there is a native hydrangea here. It's the oak leaf hydrangea. They're great. They're wonderful. The oak leaf hydrangeas. They have white flowers with a pink blush sometimes, or sometimes they're pure white. There's different varieties of oak leaf hydrangeas. They're quite nice. So you can try those in full shade. They're really good. I like them a lot. They're a little bit harder to grow, but a lot of people grow them and really enjoy them. So, and they have the pointy flowers. I believe they're called panicle flowers or pinnacle flowers or something like that, the pointy ones. But yeah, I certainly miss the mop head types. They're great, but they're only great temporarily. So yeah, okay. Got another question here. It says, "What type of top dressing should I use for my soil? The soil's basically sandy loam. I have a lot of compaction, and it's basically just the Bermuda grass turf that the builders put in several years ago. Great question. This is a really good time of year for top dressing your lawn and feeding your lawn. So any kind of compost will work. Okay, any kind of compost that you can get your hands on will work for top dressing your grass. And top dressing with compost is really, really important for keeping healthy turf grass. It's going to improve the soil. It's going to colonize basically inoculate the soil with beneficial microorganisms that will colonize the roots of the grass and help prevent diseases. It's going to help make the soil less compact, which you said is your problem, compaction. That way you'll get more air and water penetration into the soil. Okay. So basically any kind of compost will work. I prefer poultry compost if you can get it. So we're talking about turkeys and chickens. Okay. Turkey or chicken manure is great once it's been composted, once it's aged. Don't use it fresh because it'll burn the plants. So aged turkey or chicken manure is what you want. And you just put a thin layer, like a quarter inch on top of the grass, and rake it out. All right, don't let it pile up on the grass because it'll prevent the grass from getting light and then it'll get patchy. Right? So you don't want to pile it up too much where the grass is getting the light blocked from it. And then water it in. Okay, so you spread the compost out and then water it in. Now, if you have a sprinkler system, you can turn the sprinkler on and that will water the compost in. And that just means you're washing the compost off of the leaves of the grass, like off of the grass blades and down onto the soil. All right, so that's an important part. And if you have sprinkler system, you can do that. If you have a hose end sprayer, you can use the hose end sprayer with some soil activator or some seaweed or something like that, some really good fish fertilizer, and rinse it in with that. And then you're getting that feeding going too. So we're at the top of the hour here and my time is over with y'all. I will see you next week. Enjoy that eclipse. Bye.